This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Country Music Week on Fresh Air, and today the series continues with Merle Haggard, George Jones, and songwriter Bobby Braddock, who wrote Jones's hit He Stopped Loving Her Today. We start with songwriter and singer Merle Haggard. Music writer Peter Guralnick has said about Haggard, "There is no one in contemporary popular music who has created a more impressive legacy or one that spans a wider variety of styles." Haggard's best-known songs include Mama Tried, The Bottle Let Me Down, Okie from Muskogee, and Today I Started Loving You Again. He was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 1994. Haggard hardly seemed destined for success when he was in and out of reform school and prison. The prison experiences are reflected in some of his songs. Let's start with one of his best-known songs.
Each night I leave the barroom when it's over, not feeling any pain at closing time. But tonight your memory found me much too sober. Couldn't drink enough to keep you off my mind. Tonight the bottle let me down.
I spoke with Merle Haggard in 1995, just a week before he received a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys. He told me how he started hopping freight trains as a kid.
I lived in an oil community called Oildale, and there was a daily train that went into the oil fields, and it was a steam train back in those days, and I actually grew up every evening, you know, kind of looking forward to seeing that old train pull out of there with about 40 or 50 oil tankers back during the war, you know, and it was less than a stone's, well, maybe 150 feet from my back door to where the railroad track ran, and I actually grew up right next to it. My dad worked for the Santa Fe Railroad, and he only lived, I was 9 when he passed away, but I think probably the first time I ever jumped on that old oil tanker was probably, I was about 5 years old. My mother would have died, or she'd have known I'd been up there. We used to put pennies on the track, you know, and we'd hop that old train, ride a block or two, and jump off. So it was something we learned to do young. And we'd watch the brakemen and the trainmen do it, you know, and it wasn't really all that hard.
What's the worst or the most surprising experience that you had on a freight train?
The worst? There's a lot of bad experiences. I got on a freight in Oregon one time, and it was leaving out of Eugene, and it went up into the Cascades and into a snowstorm, and I was traveling in the ice compartment, and it... me and two other oboes was in there, and it got rather cold in that metal. And I remember they stopped up in the mountains and then climbed up out of that ice compartment, and I'm shaking so bad that I dropped my suitcase off the top of the freight and I had to get off for a while to get her up my clothes.
Just sounds awful. Did you have frostbite?
Somehow or another, somebody watched out for me. I didn't get anything like that.
Merle Haggard is my guest. Now, there's a new CD collection that brings together your recordings from 1963 to 1977. It's called The Lonesome Fugitive. And why don't I play one of the songs featured on there that you wrote? This was first recorded by you in 1968. It's Mama Tried.
The first thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind, but Mama tried. The one and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my Mama seemed to know what lay in store. Despite all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till Mama couldn't hold me anymore. I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
Merle Haggard, is this song autobiographical?
Well, it really is very, very close, at least. There's some things we fudged on slightly to make it rhyme, but the majority of it, I'd say 97% of it's pretty accurate, I guess.
Your father died when you were 9, is that right?
9.
So right. Your mother had to raise you alone after that.
Yeah, and I was, to say the least, probably the most incorrigible child you could think of. I was already on the way to prison before I realized it, actually. I was really kind of a screw-up. But I really don't know why. I think it was mostly just out of boredom and lack of a father's attention, I think.
I think you were 14 when your mother put you in a juvenile home?
No, she didn't put me in a juvenile home. The authorities put me in there for truancy, for not going to school, and they gave me 6 months in like a road camp situation, and I ran off from there and stole a car, and then the next time I went back, it was for something serious, and then I spent the next 7 years running off from places. I think I escaped 17 times.
How would you escape from reform school and youth institutions?
Well, there was different institutions and different methods. There was some of them were minimum security, some were maximum security, and some of them were kid joints, and some of them were adult jailhouses. And I just didn't stay nowhere. I was just. I think Willie Sutton was my idol. If you don't know, you know, at the time I was in the middle of becoming an outlaw and escaping from jail and escaping from places that they had me locked up in was part of the thing that I wanted to do.
So, what was your most ingenious escape?
Probably the one that was the most ingenious was one that I didn't actually go on. I was San Quentin. I was all set to go with the only completely successful escape out of San Quentin, I think, in 21 years. But the people that gave me the chance to go were the same people that talked me out of it, because they felt like that I was just doing it for the sport of it, and then it was a very serious thing to the other fellow that was going, and they had a big judge's chamber sort of desk that they were building at the furniture factory in San Quentin, and I had a friend who was building a place for two guys to be transported out. That was before they had x-rays and things of that nature, and I could have gone, and I didn't go, and the guy that I went with wound up being executed in the gas chamber. He went out and held court in the street, killed a highway patrolman, and so it was really good that I didn't go.
Was that a real sobering experience for you?
Yeah, I've had a lot of those things in my life, and those are the sort of things that a guy unknowingly, like myself, I guess I was gathering up meat for songs, you know. I don't know what I was doing. I really kind of was crazy as a kid, and then all of a sudden, you know, and while I was in San Quentin, I just uh, I one day understood that I saw the light, and I just didn't want to do that no more. And I realized what a mess I'd made out of my life, and I got out of there and stayed out of there. Never did go back, and went and apologized to all the people I'd wronged, and tried to pay back the people that I'd taken money from, borrowed money from, or whatever. And I think when I was 31 years old, I paid everybody back that I'd ever taken anything from, and including my mother.
What'd you say to your mother when you changed your life around?
Well, it was just obvious. No, and, you know, there was no. I don't think there was ever any time that anybody in my family was worried about me staying with this. It was just the way that, you know, some people grow up in the Army, and you know, it's hard to be 18 years old, and you know, they send 18-year-old boys to war because they don't know what to do with them. And I was one that I wound up going to prison rather than war. And instead of growing up in the middle of a battlefield with bullets flying around me, I grew up on the isolation ward, death row. And that's where the song Mama Tried gets close to being autobiographical.
You were on death row?
Yeah, I was. I got caught for making beer. Making some beer up there, and I got too much of my own beer and got drunk in the yard and got arrested. And it's hard to get arrested in San Quentin, but I did. And they sent me to what was known as the Shelf, and the Shelf is a part of the North Block, which you share with the inmates on death row. And that was the, as you put it, sobering experience for me. I wound up with nothing to lay on except a Bible in an old concrete slab, and woke up from that drunk that I'd been on that day, and I could hear some prisoners talking in the area next to me. In other words, there was a alleyway between the back of the cells, and I could hear people talking over there, and I recognized the guy as being Carol Chessman, a guy that they were fixing to execute. And I don't know, it was just something about the whole situation that I knew that if I ever got out of there, if I was lucky enough to get out, I made up my mind while I still had that hangover that I was all finished.
How were you lucky enough to get out?
Well, I went back down on the yard and went down and asked for the roughest job in the penitentiary, which was a textile mill, and went down and just started building my reputation, you know, just started running in reverse from what I'd been doing and started trying to build up a long line of good things to be proud of, and that's what I've been doing since then.
Did your musical ability have anything to do with people noticing you in prison and thinking that you could make it when you got out? I mean, did that help you at all in the war?
Yeah, that was the basic reason, I think, that these friends of mine talked me out of going on that escape. I mean, they felt that I had talent, and they felt that I was just a ornery kid and could probably make something out of my life. And you know, believe it or not, in the penitentiary, there's some pretty nice people and very unfortunate people. And they love to let somebody, so to speak, get up on their shoulders. You know, they like to boost somebody over the wall if they can. If they can't make it themselves, they, I think, sincerely love to see someone else make it.
When you started writing songs, did you realize that you could write autobiographical songs from your own life, or did you think you had to copy other people's songs?
Well, I really didn't realize what method to take at first. I must have wrote maybe 1,500 songs that weren't any good, or at least I never kept them, and finally was with a lot of help and a lot of people who had written hit songs, who I'd become friends with, such as Fuzzy Owen, who became my personal manager, was a songwriter, and he helped me he taught me how to write songs, and finally I wrote one that was worth keeping, and I think I've written about 300 keepers or so, maybe 400.
Do you remember the first one that you felt this is worth keeping?
Yeah, it was a sort of a rock and roll song, or a Elvis-type rock and roll thing. It was called If You Want to Be My Woman. Glenn Campbell opened his shows with it for years, and I still do the song. And I wrote it when I was about 14. But I didn't keep very many. That was probably one out of that 1,500 that got kept.
Could you sing a couple of bars of it?
You like riding in the country in my Cadillac. And you keep, I keep pushing me back. Something about on the money that I earned, but you refused to give me something equal in return. Don't look at me like maybe you don't understand. If you want to be my woman, you know you got to let me be your man.
And how old were you when you wrote
something
it?
Like that.
How old were you?
14.
Wow. So this is just about the time that you started that whole round of reform schools.
Yeah, I might have been as much as 15 or 16 when I wrote that song. It was between 14 and 17, I'm not sure.
Now, during all the years that you were in and out of prisons and reform schools, did you ever think I can make a living with music?
No, I counted on extra money, as I was saying, maybe a hobby. I figured I was going to have some other means of employment, support.
So what made you think, well, I can make a living out of this?
Well, when I came out of the penitentiary, I went to work for my brother digging ditches and wiring houses. He had an electrical company, Hag Electric. And he was paying me $80 a week. This was 1960, and I was working 8 hours a day there. And I got me a little gig playing guitar 4 nights a week for $10 a night. There was a little radio show that we had to broadcast from this little nightclub called High Pockets. It just all started from that. Some people that was local stars around heard me on this radio program and came down and offered me a better job in town, and it wasn't just a matter of weeks till I was part of the main clique in Bakersfield, and it was hard to get in that clique. There was a lot of people like Buck Owens, and there was people that were really good and proved how good they were later on with their success, and Bakersfield was some sort of a, I don't know, it was like country music artists found their way to Bakersfield and had their success out of there. I don't understand why, actually. It may be because of the migration that took place in the 30s or whatever. There was a lot of people that came out there from Oklahoma and Arkansas and Texas that had a lot of soul. And this thing we call country music kind of came out of those honky-tonks, some of the same area that a lot of other things came out of.
Was it hard for you to adjust to success and stardom, having come from poverty and, having lived in prison off and on for so many years? I think it's hard for a lot of people to adjust to that.
Well, a lot of people may or may not understand how hard it is for a person coming out of an institution, whether it be a prison or whether it be some sort of a mental institution, whether it be the Army or whatever. There's a thing that happens, like when you leave the penitentiary, when you've been there for 3 years, you have friends and you have a way of life and you have a routine and a whole way of life that you just give up all of a sudden. One day you're there and you're, next day you're not there, and you don't have any more friends from the outside because things went on when you left and you can't find anybody there, and the people you left behind in prison are really your only friends. And there's a period of adjustment that took me about 120 days, I don't know, about 4 months. A couple of times I really wanted to go back. And it's really a weird sensation. It's the loneliest feeling in the world about the second night out of the penitentiary.
My interview with Merle Haggard was recorded in 1995. Our Country Music Week continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Today I started loving you again. I'm right back where I've really always been. I got over you just long enough to let my heart ache mend. Then today I started loving you again. What a fool I was to think I could get by.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, continuing our country music series with singer George Jones. Waylon Jennings once said, if we could all sound like we wanted to, we'd all sound like George Jones. Rock stars like Elvis Costello and Keith Richards have also paid tribute to George Jones. This was his first big hit, She Thinks I Still Care, recorded in 1962.
Because I rang her number by mistake today, she thinks I still care.
I spoke with George Jones in 1996 after the publication of his autobiography, which described the many years he was addicted to alcohol and cocaine and gave his perspective on his celebrated but troubled marriage to Tammy Wynette. Jones grew up in rural Texas during the Depression. His father made bootleg whiskey to help make ends meet. Jones first performed at the age of 9 in Pentecostal churches and revival meetings. After helping to save souls in his early teens, he played to the sinners at rough-and-tumble roadhouses. He was underage, but he worked with a married couple who served as his guardians. Jones told me fights often broke out while the band played.
Back in those late 40s, when I was appearing in these places with them, you know, we had to put chicken wire around the bandstand, the little stage we had, to keep bottles from flying over and busting our guitars up. It would be brawls break out every hour or so. But we got through it. It was part of the training, I guess.
Were those bottles intended for the band, or were they just accidentally
really
hitting you?
Not really. There's one or two that get in a fight and start something and then get knocked into another one, and he'd get mad and he'd join in fighting them. So next thing you know, there's a dozen fighting and tables turning over and bottles are flying, throwing in, at each other, you know, and they'd naturally head that way too, you know.
So when there was fighting when you were playing, would you just keep playing?
Well, we were told to do that, and that's what we've done most of the time, until, you know, it got really too rough to continue, and then we'd quietly bow out and get out of the way.
Let's see, you were married at age 17, divorced a little less than a year later, I think, went into the Marines for a couple of years. How soon did you start recording when you got out of the Marines? And I guess it was 1954.
Right away, in that following February of 54, I went into the studio the first time, and we didn't do all that good until 56, I think, or 55. We lucked up with a tune called Why Baby Why, and then we moved on to Nashville to a larger company that could distribute, you know, records better.
Well, why don't we hear Why Baby Why, recorded in 1955. One of the things interesting about this is that I think really you're best known for your ballads. And this is really up-tempo.
Well, the first days were rough, you know. The early days we recorded for Starday Records, and really it was terrible sound. We recorded in a small living room of a house on the highway near Beaumont. You could hear the trucks. We had to stop a lot of times because it wasn't soundproof. It was just egg crates nailed on the wall, and the big old semi trucks would go by and make a lot of noise, and then we'd have to start over again.
So George Jones, let's hear your first hit, recorded in 1955. Why, Baby, Why?
Tell me why, baby, why, baby, why, baby, why you make me cry, baby, cry, baby, cry, baby, cry. I can't help but love you till the day that I die, so tell me why, baby, why, baby, why? Well, now I've got a crow I want to pick with you, just like last time when the feathers flew. You're running wild, kicking up your heels, leaving me home with a handful of bills. Well, I can't live without you, and you know it's true, but there's no living with you, so what'll I do? I'm going honky-tonk and get as tight as I can, and maybe by then you'll appreciate a good man. Tell me why, baby, why, baby, why, baby, why you make me cry, baby, cry, baby, cry, baby, cry.
That's George Jones, his first hit back in 1955. George Jones, how did this record affect your life? How did it change your life?
Well, it gave me a little more to eat and got me to traveling around, driving my car and to places close to East Texas, the big cities, Houston, Dallas, and over into Louisiana, sometimes Oklahoma. And it was a local hit for me. It was a national hit for Red Sovine and Webb Pierce, which back at that time, Webb Pierce was about the number one big star that was recording at the time.
Now, how did you get the reputation as No Show Jones, of not showing up for dates?
Well, that was easy as time went by. No, I just I missed a few dates back when I was doing a little bit too much of my drinking, and later on I got into drugs. But I didn't really miss as many dates as it's been built up to be, but a lot of things the fans and people didn't know that the management that I had around me at the time were also booking dates on me several dates on the same date, and getting advanced monies for the dates. And they knew I would get the blame, you know, for it, that they would never have to refund those monies. So I wound up with so many lawsuits that I didn't know what to do with. So finally got it all straightened out, though, thank goodness, and we don't have to worry about all that anymore.
Let's hear another one of your songs, and this is These Days I Barely Get By, which was co-written by you and by Tammy Wynette, and I think you recorded this shortly before or shortly after you separated.
I think so.
Do you remember which it was?
No, but I'm sure it was just before we separated and got divorced.
Tell me what your life was like when you recorded this.
Well, it was already getting to one of the lowest points in my life from drinking so much. And this was what led to a lot to the cause of the divorce. And you know most of the story after that.
Okay, well, this is These Days I Barely Get By, sung by my guest George Jones.
I woke up this morning aching with pain. Don't think I can work, but I'll try. The car's in the shop, so I thumbed all the way. Oh, these days I barely get by. I walked home from work and it rained all the way. My wife left and didn't say in the hall.
George Jones, recorded in the mid-70s. I'm wondering, if you're truly living the lyric that you're singing about, do you think that that helps you make it even more expressive?
The song, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I certainly do. I know when I'm singing a song on stage or recording one in the studio, I have to get deeply involved in it. And if not, you can't put the emotions and the feelings, and I don't think they come out if you don't.
Let me play the song that you say turned your life around. And this is He Stopped Loving Her Today. Now, you had the song for about a year before recording it, and you asked the songwriter to rewrite it several times. What was the original song like? How is it different from what you recorded? And why did you think it needed to be changed?
Well, when I first got the song and first heard it, it didn't have the last verse of the recitation part. I kept telling them that the lady had to come back. You know, the girl had to come back one way or the other, either to see him or come to his funeral or something. And they went back and rewrote and wrote the last verse then that, where I do the recitation, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you still sing
this? That was when she came to the funeral, you know.
Do you still sing the song a lot?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, recorded in 1980. This is George Jones, He Stopped Loving Her Today.
He stopped loving her today. They placed a wreath upon his door. And soon stop loving her today. You know, she came to see him one last time. Oh, and we all wondered if she would. And it kept running through my mind. This time he's over her for good. He stopped loving her today. It placed a wreath upon his door. And soon they'll carry him away. He stopped loving her today.
My interview with George Jones was recorded in 1996. The song we just heard him sing, He Stopped Loving Her Today, was co-written by Bobby Braddock, who also co-wrote Tammy Wynette's hit, D-I-V-O-R-C-E. Braddock will talk about writing those songs after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our Country Music Week continues with Bobby Braddock, who wrote George Jones's hit, He Stopped Loving Her Today, and co-wrote Tammy Wynette's hit, D-I-V-O-R-C-E, before she married George Jones. Braddock also wrote Tanya Tucker's I Believe the South is Gonna Rise Again and Toby Keith's I Wanna Talk About Me. Bobby Braddock was inducted into the Nashville Hall of Fame in 1981. After decades of lyric writing, he wrote a memoir about growing up in old Florida. I interviewed him when it was published in 2007. Let's start with the Braddock song that was a number one hit on the country music charts in 1968. Here's Tammy Wynette.
Our little boy is 4 years old and quite a little man. So we spell out the words we don't want him to understand. Like T-O-Y or maybe S-U-R-P-R-I-S-E. But the words we're hiding from him now tear the heart right out of me. Our D-I-V-O-R-C-E becomes final today. Me and little J-O-E will be going away. I love you both and this will be pure A-G-double-E.
Bobby Braddock, welcome to Fresh Air. So tell us the story behind this song. How did you write it?
The Evioracy, I had written a song called I-L-O-V-E-Y-O-U. Do I have to spell it out for you? And it wasn't very good. And that sort of inspired this song. I wrote it. Nobody recorded it. I asked my friend Curly Putman why did he think no one had recorded it. And he said he thought the melody was a little bit too happy for a sad song. And I said, what would you do? And he got around the title line and just made it sound real mournful. And mine sounded sort of like a detergent commercial. And I said, hey, let's get it on tape like that. And he didn't want any of it. And I wanted him to have half. So we compromised and he took a quarter of it. And Tammy Wynette recorded it within, I'd say, probably a week or two after that.
Can you sing us the more upbeat version that you originally wrote?
Okay, what I had was, everything else was the same except the title line. I had, oh, I wish that we could stop this D-I-V-O-R-C-E. And Curly changed it to, I wish that we could stop this D-I-V-O-R-C-E, which made it a lot better. And that little change made the difference, I think, between it being a hit and just gathering cobwebs and nobody ever having heard it.
Let's talk about another of your most famous songs, a song recorded by George Jones, He Stopped Loving Her Today. And after we talk about it a little bit, we'll hear it. Now, this song tells a story. Would you describe the story?
It's a story of a man who whose love was so strong that the only way he could get over this woman was to die. I think he was a terrible role model, a very bad role model. The man was obsessed with this woman, and he never got over. He never moved on. Again, this is one I wrote with Curly Putman. I thought it was just an okay song. I didn't think it was that great a song. And when the producer Billy Sherrill played me George's recording of it, I thought, "Wow, this is something really great." I think in this instance, the artist and the production elevated the song to a place that it wouldn't have been otherwise. I really attribute so much of the success of this to George Jones and his producer.
He stopped loving her today. It placed a wreath upon his door. And soon stop loving her today. You know, she came to see him one last time. Oh, and we all wondered if she were.
Bobby Braddock, the word schmaltz is probably not a word that's used a lot in country music, but it's a word that comes to mind with parts of the song. Schmaltz being like overly sentimental or, you know, almost maudlin. Did you think this is really going to be over the top?
I think in the hands of anyone other than George Jones, it would have been really schmaltzy. And there's such an intense believability about it. There's a little story that goes with this, and I think it's okay to tell it, that as George was performing, in those days, the recordings were pretty much done. The vocals were often done with the band on the original tracking session as opposed to now when they're done separately later on. And George had sung this once, and at that time, his ex, Tammy Wynette, came into the control room with her new boyfriend, who was also a friend of George, George Ritchie. And she sat down next to the producer, Billy Sherrill, in the control room. And Billy said, George, you need to sing it one more time. And so as George sang it, he was looking in the control room, and Tammy's face was, I mean, Tammy Wynette, the love of George Jones' life at that time, her face was illuminated, and he was looking right at her as he sang that song. So I think that probably put a little more poignancy into what was going on that day.
That's the take you used, huh?
Mm-hmm. That's the take that we hear, yeah.
Now, you were signed to Tree Music, which I think was probably the biggest country music publisher. Is that
fair?
It was. It wasn't the giant then that it is now. And, of course, it is now Sony/ATV slash Tree.
Now, what was the approach of Tree Music to matching, well, to deciding whether a song was worthy of being recorded, and if so, who would be chosen to sing it, or who would be asked to sing it?
My memory is of just turning in a bunch of songs, them liking the songs, and getting out there on the street and getting them cut, which is pretty easy. There were not a lot of discussions about it. If they didn't like a song, they told me, you know, and more than likely the next song or two I brought them, there would be something that they would like.
Did you ever think, oh, not him, don't give it to him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I thought that a lot. Yeah, and that still happens.
Do you say anything, or do you figure, well, maybe it'll be a hit anyways?
Yeah, I think maybe it'll be a hit anyway. And eventually I became a song plugger myself and got quite a few, including the Toby Keith thing. I want to talk about me. I got that cut. And
what do you mean when you say you became a song plugger?
I just decided to go out and start pitching my own songs around.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up the Toby Keith record. This is unusual because it's a kind of rap country song. So what gave you the idea to do that?
I think it's the only number one country rap song, you know. And they probably don't need to be anymore. I got the idea for that song, Terry, but I had a friend who I talked to quite a bit on the phone, and she was going through a lot of stressful personal things, and she seemed to pretty much dominate the conversation with things that were going on in her life. So she was an inspiration to the song, and I was producing, had just begun producing a young man named Blake Shelton that I had a lot of success with producing in the past few years. And he went around doing this little rap thing just to cut up, and I thought it would be good to write a country song in rap form for him to record. And the record label thought, well, this wouldn't be a good first record for a new artist, and they were probably right. So then I took it to Toby Keith's producer, and he immediately liked it for Toby.
And he had a number one hit for 5 weeks.
For 5 weeks in a row, yeah. This probably as big a song as I ever had. It's probably as big as He Stopped Loving Her Today.
Why don't we hear it? That's Toby Keith, recorded in 2001. I Want to Talk About Me, written by my guest, Bobby Braddock.
We talk about your work, how your boss is a jerk. We talk about your church and your head when it hurts. We talk about the troubles you've been having with your brother, about your daddy and your mother and your crazy ex-lover. We talk about your friends and the places that you've been. We talk about your skin and the dimples on your chin, the polish on your toes and the run in your holes. And God knows we're going to talk about your clothes. You know talking about you makes me smile. But every once in a while, I want to talk about me, want to talk about I, want to talk about number one. Oh my, me, my, what I think, what I like, what I know, what I want, what I see. I like talking about you, usually. But occasionally, I want to talk about me. I want to talk about me. Talk about your dreams and we talk about your schemes.
You know, a lot of people think of, like, George Jones country music and, say, Toby Keith country music as being two different forms altogether from two different eras of country music. You've, of course, had hits in both styles, both eras. Do you see that those two being as disconnected as some other people do?
I haven't really thought about it that much. Of course, sonically it's different because for the most part it's from different eras.
What are some of the sonic differences from the different eras?
For one thing, I can identify from different eras by the amount of reverb and the amount of delay that they have on them, which are technical things. But I'll tell you one difference now is singers are tuned. There are singers out there who do not have really good pitch, who probably could not have gotten deals years ago, who now, if they look good and if they have an interesting delivery and have an interesting personality, then they might get a record deal because their flatness or sharpness can be tuned. Toby Keith is not one of those. Toby live sounds pretty much like he does when he's recording. The attitude, Toby's got quite a bit of attitude, chutzpah. George comes from a different era. and it's more of a from the perspective of somebody maybe who does not have as much self-confidence. And this was an era when country music was about, she went off and left me, you know, my heart's broken. I can't imagine Toby Keith saying, baby, you left me, I love you so much, please come back to me. Country singers did a lot of that back in the 50s and 60s. You don't hear as much about that now. They inject themselves into the songs personally a lot, too. You know, you hear a songwriter saying, well, I wouldn't say that. Thankfully, you don't hear a lot of actors saying, well, I wouldn't say that, you know?
And, well, that's the point. You're acting.
I know. Yeah. I know. So that's a big difference.
Bobby Braddock, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Country music songwriter Bobby Braddock recorded in 2007. Our Country Music Week continues tomorrow. We're collecting all the interviews from our Country Music Week series on one webpage. You'll find a link on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross. Here's Tammy Wynette and George Jones singing a song by Bobby Braddock.
In a pawn shop in Chicago, on a sunny summer day, a couple gazes at the wedding rings there on display. She smiles.